It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we prepare to feast over the holidays and give our digestive systems a real workout, we want to talk about gut health, the bacteria, and sometimes the parasites that can reside in our digestive systems. Later in the program, we'll check in with a microbiologist to find out the good, the bad, the ugly when it comes to the bacteria that dwell in our digestive tracts. But first, some new research out of Iowa State University that aims to alter a parasite that infects hundreds of millions of people in developing nations. It causes hundreds of thousands of deaths in Africa each year. Joining me to talk about this new research, Tim Day, professor of biomedical sciences at ISU. Tim's been conducting research in this area for over a decade, and he's leading the team of ISU researchers on this new study. Tim Day, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Ben.
Well, tell us about these, I understand they're sort of flatworms you're studying. They have, go by the name schistosomes, if I've got the correct pronunciation.
You did very well, Ben. Yeah, schistosomes, parasitic worms, come in kind of two flavors, flatworms and roundworms, which is kind of a vernacular way to say it, but it's really very descriptive. And schistosomes cause a disease that is called schistosomiasis. And schistosomiasis afflicts about 250 million people throughout the world, most of them in Africa, a large chunk of those in sub-Saharan Africa. And there's a large link, there's a really tight link between poverty and neglected diseases like schistosomiasis. And so many kids suffer from schistosomiasis, and only a small fraction of those receive the treatment that they need every year.
Mm-hmm. How do you get this worm in your body?
Yeah, so the worms come, it's a complex life cycle that involves snails, so there has to be an appropriate species of snails available in the water. And so the eggs come out of humans either in urine or feces. They reside then a swimming form in infect snails, and then they undergo development in the snails at certain times of the year and certain times of day. Another swimming form emerges from the snails and burrows through the skin of humans, and when they do so, find themselves in the bloodstream and actually take a really long route through the body and end up in the vasculature around the gut, end up in the bloodstream around the gut.
Boy, that sounds horrible. What makes them unique or different than other parasites that may get into our bloodstream, into our gut?
Yeah. So schistosomes, it's kind of curious in that schistosomes themselves, they're male and female schistosomes, in and of themselves, they wouldn't cause a lot of pathology, except that the females produce a copious number of eggs and large numbers of eggs that are targeted. They're meant to get back out in the environment and therefore kind of continue the life cycle. But after a while, scar tissue forms over the bladder and over the intestine, and a large percentage of these eggs ends up getting swept into the liver, where they cause all kinds of health issues. So most of the pathology is associated with eggs that don't successfully exit the body.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of symptoms does a person have?
So if you've seen, Ben, pictures of kids in Africa with swollen up bellies and guts, a lot of times that's schistosomiasis. What will happen is their liver will respond by growing to be multiple sizes of a normal liver, 7 to 10 times the size of a normal liver. And when that happens, it causes all kinds of collateral health problems.
Mm. Okay. So in developing nations, talk more about the impact that this is having. I mentioned that briefly in the introduction.
Yeah, that's a great question, Ben. And it's really hard to quantify, and there's a lot of different ways to quantify it. You can quantify the effects of schistosomiasis and say that it may be the second or third most impactful disease in the world, second only to malaria or third to HIV. It causes a lot of developmental problems and cognitive problems in kids that are chronically infected when they're young. And part of the problem is when the kids are first infected, they don't show tons of symptoms. And even when they do, it's often hard to get treatment to them. So kids can be chronically infected for a long time. And that has effects on kids that we're not even sure that we can quantify yet. But we do know that children who are chronically infected have other health problems and also have cognitive developmental problems that are very difficult for them to overcome even as they get older.
I'm surprised when I hear you talk about the impact of these parasites and that it's on par with the impact of malaria or HIV around the world. And yet, most of us don't hear about it. Why not?
Yeah. So this is in a pool of diseases that the World Health Organization has classified as neglected tropical diseases. And neglected kind of answers a little bit of that question or speaks to that question, Ben. These diseases don't tend to get much attention from you and I, and also much attention from the pharmaceutical industry. And that's not to paint them in a negative light. The fact is that the people who have these diseases have very little financial resources. So there's very little financial incentive to develop new treatment paradigms to try to combat these diseases and the effects of these diseases. So the truth is these diseases are rightly classified as neglected. The amount of financial resources that go to trying to solve these problems is very, very tiny relative to the impact that they have throughout the world.
Tim Day is a professor of biomedical sciences at Iowa State University. Tim, before we get to your team's research there, tell us, once you get this, how is it treated? Is it treated with drugs to try to kill the parasites?
Yep, that's exactly right, Ben. There are there's really one drug that's available in most parts of the world. It's a drug called praziquantel. We use it in the U.S. to treat tapeworm infections in horses and cats and dogs. And it's actually a great medicine, does a fantastic job with a single dose, can cure the disease. Now, unfortunately, most of the people that get it because of environmental factors will end up getting reinfected. So drugs are the only approach we have right now to combat the disease.
Mm-hmm. Until you make their conditions in developing countries more sanitary, drinking water and so forth, you're going to get rid of it and get it again and again.
That's exactly right, Ben. And so, along with treating the disease, actually having a longer-term impact requires infrastructure development. It requires nutritional supplements to the chemotherapy that kids take in order to avoid the disease. And really, unfortunately, I think that the drug that we have, praziquantel, is very widely distributed in some places to the point that there's already the fear that resistance is starting to develop to the drug. And if we have only one drug and resistance develops, it really is a very precarious situation.
Mm-hmm. I guess I didn't ask. You talked about the global impact of this parasite, but what about here in the U.S.? How much of a concern is it in the U.S. or here in the Midwest?
Yeah, really only a traveler concern here. There are certainly parts of Puerto Rico and Mexico and South America where the disease is endemic, but not even in those cases is it very prevalent. With more ecotourism, we're seeing more of it in the U.S., more cases in the U.S., but it's really a traveler-based problem.
So if people are going abroad, listeners are planning a trip perhaps over abroad over the holidays, is it something you need to ask your doctor about?
Yeah, probably not, because if you do come down with the disease, it's relatively easy to treat. I've been, to be more practical, when I go to Africa, if I'm going to go swimming in streams and in lakes, I would look to see if I see a lot of snails around. And if I do, I would usually choose not to go swimming in those places.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk now about your research. Your team has been looking at a different way of tackling this major problem with the schistosomes. Yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah, Ben, we're really fortunate to have obtained some funding from the Gates Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been very aggressive in trying to infuse money into new kind of even, I'll use the word far-fetched, or let's say speculative approaches to diseases like this that have been so hard to deal with. And they funded a project right now in which we're looking at some very new approaches to trying to treat the disease. As you asked, Ben, most of our approaches right now deal with chemotherapy, dealing with drugs that directly kill the worms. And all of those are interacting with very specific proteins in the worm that cause the worm to not be able to do the kinds of things it needs to do in order to stay alive. And mostly those drugs target neuromuscular systems, just like most of the drugs that we use to treat parasitic worms in cattle and in livestock and in pets in the U.S., they attack the neuromuscular systems. We're looking at a whole new place. We're investigating a whole new line of research in which we're trying to ask if there are ways that the parasite is altering the host in order to make the host more amenable to parasitism. And we're trying to interfere with the ways the parasite is trying to manipulate the environment of the host in order to make it a better host for parasitism.
So if I – maybe this is a bad comparison, but just like a serial killer, you're trying to put yourself in the shoes and understand that serial killer.
Yeah, maybe that is a good analogy. I've not used it, but I might pencil that down. I probably won't give you credit for it, Ben, if I use
That's all right.
But we've studied for a long time. We've looked at the ways that worms, when they infect their hosts, and this is true in plants, those that affect soybeans, those that affect cattle, those that affect humans, we know that those worms do things to modify the host that makes the host environment better for them.
Like what?
Well, we've always looked at, I'll give you a very, I think, tangible example for people in the Midwest. We know that when soybean cyst nematodes invade the plant, they secrete some proteins, and those proteins alter the gene expression in the plant so that the plant modifies one of its cells to become a giant feeding site for the parasite. So the parasite changes what the plant cell is doing, and that makes it a better host for the parasite. Mm-hmm. And we've always looked at the kind of proteins because we've always thought about the fact that proteins alter gene expression. And what we've been looking at is the fact that we know now over the last 10 years, it's become very clear that small RNAs are also important in modifying gene expression.
Okay, so once you understand better how this parasite, schistosomes, alter their hosts, what do you hope to do with that information?
Yeah, try to interfere with those mechanisms. If we interfere with the signals that the schistosome sends in order to modify the host, it's possible that then the schistosome would be less successful in infecting the host or less successful in establishing parasitism in the host. Mm-hmm. And that's really our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is to interfere with the RNA signals that schistosomes are sending to their host that they need to do to modify the host's immune system, for example. We know these worms change the function of the immune system in animals that they parasitize. Mm-hmm. So if we could block their ability to make those changes in the immune system, it's possible the schistosome could not even successfully parasitize the host.
Such a complicated system you're working in there, our bodies, our guts, and things like that. I wonder if you have to worry about unintended consequences of getting in there with your tools and making such changes.
Absolutely, Ben. Absolutely. It's always a question as to what are the unintended consequences. If, for example, one of the things that we found years ago is that the drug praziquantel that we use it's great. It works really well. There are some people that metabolize that drug so quickly that it almost renders the drug ineffective in those people. Well, any attempts to alter those patients' ability to metabolize the drug alters their biology in general and really has unintended consequences of interfering with their ability to metabolize other things that they need to metabolize. So all kinds of questions, the questions you've raised are very good ones, Ben, and they're ones that have to be attended to as you walk down this pathway.
So concerning this parasite, what is your ultimate goal or the medical community concerned with rendering this parasite inoperable?
Right.
Is it to eradicate it?
Yeah, again, a really great question. Right now, that's not on the table for schistosomiasis. And as we look at the 17 neglected tropical diseases, some are targeted for eradication. Right now, it's hard to see that horizon for schistosomiasis. For schistosomiasis, the goal would be to control morbidity of the disease and to control transmission, but breaking the life cycle, which has happened for some of these worms. Dracunculus is now almost eradicated from the earth, a parasitic worm, and we've had great success in interfering with Brugia. The worm that causes elephantiasis has been eradicated in China, and elephantiasis has almost been eradicated here in the Americas. But schistosomiasis isn't really on the list of neglected diseases where we can realistically envision eradication of the disease at this point. The goals are to control morbidity.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a silly question, but do parasites, are they, we know bacteria, there are good and bad ones that get into our gut. Is the same true of parasites, or is it always bad?
One of the things that my colleague, a postdoctoral associate, Mustafa Zamanian, is working on is exactly that. And it sounds a little weird. So even as I say it, it sounds weird to me, Ben. But schistosomes, as I explained earlier, if they don't release a large number of eggs, in fact, they're not very pathological to the host. In fact, one of the great things that can happen for a kid is to get a small infection when they're very young, and that can help them fight off further infection of worms. If the worms aren't producing a large number of eggs, the pathology is not very serious. And if we could make schistosomes that didn't produce any eggs at all, they would be almost non-pathological to their host. And so one way to deal with the problem is to interfere with that process or find ways to reduce egg production in the host. Now, that wouldn't make them good. It's possible that you could engineer schistosomes to do good things, but that's not on the horizon in the short term.
Okay, Tim Day, fascinating area of research that you have, professor of biomedical sciences at Iowa State University. Thanks for sharing it with us. And I wonder, with your area of work, do you enjoy your feasts any differently than we do, or do you just get your mind right out of there?
Well, I'm on the radio, so I can report to you that I enjoy feasts of every sort as often as I can, Ben. So I don't normally have to think about gross things like worms while I'm eating, and I have successfully overcome any of those barriers to eat a lot of food every opportunity I've been given, Ben.
Tim Day, happy holidays. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you, Ben.
Tim Day is a professor of biomedical sciences at Iowa State University. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and as we are preparing to feast over the holidays and give our digestive systems a workout, we're giving ourselves a gut check this hour, a gut health check, to be more precise. It turns out that scientists are just beginning to learn about how our decisions at the dinner table change the communities of bacteria living in our bodies. One thing's becoming clear: these critters hanging out in our intestines influence many aspects of our health, including weight, immunity, disease, perhaps even behavior. My guest for the remainder of the hour is Patrick Schlievert. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Patrick Schlievert, welcome to our program.
Thank you for the invitation.
We want to reach out to our listeners for the entire rest of the hour. What questions do you have about bacteria in your gut and your health? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. In preparing for this program, I see that, Pat Schlievert, that we have an average of about 5 pounds of bacteria in our guts, an average person performing several functions. I wonder if you could start out by describing this landscape, our digestive system, and the inhabitants we have there that are helping us, and some of them we may have are harming us, right?
Sure. I'd be happy to. So our digestive system really starts with the stomach, and the stomach is very acidic. So there are essentially no microbes there unless you have ulcers, in which case you have Helicobacter. But then, and so that is normally a sterile environment. Then you move into the small intestine, and that's where the food goes after it leaves the stomach. And the small intestine is where we absorb most of our food.
This is the really long part that curls back and forth.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have very many microbes there either, because we wouldn't want them competing with us for food. So then the food then ultimately makes its way into the large intestine. And the large intestine, there are a trillion bacteria per gram of poop. So a gram is one.
By the time it gets to that point, we're calling it poop, all right?
Yeah, we're calling it poop. So there's, and in fact, there's about 500 trillion per pound of poop, if I can call it that, in the large intestine. And that's where most of these bacteria are then.
Okay. So broadly speaking, with that many there, it would be hard to get into too much detail. But what are these little critters up to?
Well, okay, so we give them three different names. We call them the microbiome, which is kind of a current term. We also call them microbiota, and we call them normal flora. So there's obviously a lot of them. And what a lot of them are doing is they're finishing processing the food that we've eaten. And they also, as they live there and grow on that, a small number of them provide us with vitamins. And then a lot of them, just because there are so many, keep other more dangerous bacteria out. And then, of course, then we lose them as we poop them out.
Yeah, okay. So how much different are our bacteria from one individual to another person? You look to be perhaps of European origin. I am as well. But what about differences between individuals and ethnicities? Are there variances there? Do we know?
Well, there are variances, but this is really an area of intense study right now. The techniques have just become available that allow these massive studies of, because if you think about the number, there are massive numbers of bacteria there, and how could you ever categorize them in individuals? So we're just really getting into that now. But there are differences. The genetics of people make a difference, but also what people eat makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. What happens when we're to that culture, that landscape, that flora, when we're born, from when we turn into adulthood? Does it grow in its diversity, for instance?
Yeah, it certainly does. When we're born, there are very few bacteria present in the intestinal tract. Only a small number have been gasped from the amniotic fluid from the mother that end up in the intestine. And then after the baby is born, if it's a breastfed baby, the baby has almost uniformly a bacterium we know as bifidobacterium. And bifidobacteria are very good bacteria. They're the reason baby poop doesn't smell bad.
That's the reason. I've always wondered. Diapers all those years, I've wondered why that is. And then when the babies switch over to solid food, it's a different story.
That's right. It's a very different story. Then all of a sudden, the very significant smells come. And we divide bacteria into pink ones and purple ones based on how they stain with a couple dyes that we use. And so what happens is after the bifidobacteria go away, and by the way, you can buy bifidobacteria in a health food store and eat them. And so when the pink ones then come in, and they're the dominant populating bacteria. They make up the vast majority of those that are found in our large intestine.
Okay, we have to take a short break, but we're going to come back with Patrick Schlievert. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. And we want to talk about so many aspects in this gut check as we continue our conversation. We want to invite you. What questions do you have about bacteria and your health? 5 pounds of bacteria in our bodies. Did you say, Pat Schlievert, they outnumber the human cells?
That is true.
Or they must be much smaller then.
Well, they're about a micrometer in diameter. So about 1/100th of a grain of salt.
Okay, we're going to talk about these little critters in our guts as we get ready to feast over the holidays, what they're up to, and also what can go wrong, what they have to do with our mental health, what they have to do with our immunity, disease, and so forth. Your questions are welcome. 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Back with more of a gut health check. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.